Cork. Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people will never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
Be involved in the conversation, the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. There was gridlock this morning. There was traffic mayhem. It involved a couple of different accidents, one of which I passed as it came off the slip there in the back village in Douglas to merge on to the South Ring heading west, and I came across the most horrific crash. I saw three. Somebody said there was 4 to 5 cars involved in it. It was a very, very, very bad multi-car collision. Now, so bad that unfortunately, I hate saying this, but one car was absolutely totaled at the front, and I hope that everybody is safe. I don't know of any injuries or anything like that, but as a result of that, then, of course, there's absolute mayhem for everybody else. So that was me. I got lucky this morning. Claire O'Connor didn't, because she was travelling up from Carrigtwohill this morning. She does have a morning. And literally just 5 minutes ago walked in the door. Somebody who'd be usually here at 7 o'clock. So that was hell.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I left Carrigtwohill about 7:15. It was all looking fine. It does get a bit congested towards the tunnel. I was in the tunnel about 7:30 and I got to Red about 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
Ago.
Now, there were two different crashes, yeah. Right? There was one, correct me if I'm wrong, because my one was a crash going west,
yes.
This multi-one. But as I was driving and got through it eventually then, as I was driving on, motoring on, it was about a mile, maybe in a mile and a half, tailback, way out almost to Corraheen for people trying to go east to the tunnel.
I noticed that as well when I was coming through. Now, I didn't see anything in the eastbound direction accident-wise, but I hit another accident before that big accident that you're even talking about.
On the other way, you're going west.
Going west, still, just
as well,
out of the
two
tunnel.
Two going west.
Yeah, so I was waiting to hit that one, which was, you know, more towards the Kinsale Road roundabout. And there I was just after the Mahon turn-off when I came out of the tunnel. On the right, two cars there were involved in a bit of a tip, looked like a kind of a merging tip, you know, the back right of one guy and the front left of another guy, and it was quite, you know, it was hard enough, nothing to be seriously injuring anyone, but again, overtaking lane was completely blocked up there, so everyone was trying to get into the left, and then, sure, I was just sitting in it then for about an hour and a half really after that, okay. Coming up to the
can we just say at this stage that our thoughts are with everybody involved in the accident, and I hope they're well, but this is happening way too often now, right?
Yeah.
And all of this, if we parked this morning now, and unfortunately, awful what happened, but for everybody else, it causes unbelievable chaos in their lives. I see texts already from people this morning. Chap has missed his driving test, right? Other people are saying, you know, every time this happens, I'm losing an hour's pay, sometimes 2 hours' pay.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's
our appointments. Some people are going to the CUH. You know, for an appointment that might have been waiting for years for. And it's all driver habit.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And, you know, we've been talking about it so much. You know, it's not only in the news and on the papers, but, like, even on the show here, we've had so many people in touch about what they're seeing on the roads, the speed, the dangerous manoeuvres, the texting, everything like that, you know.
So the tailgating,
it's
the driving
constant,
too quickly,
yeah.
The flipping from lane to lane in very dangerous situations, the merging into coming off a slip. It's bleak. Like 2024 so far has been very bleak when it comes to crashes and fatalities.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Do you want to talk to? Will I talk to Dermot now?
Yes, Dermot is there.
Okay. Thank you for that. All right. Let you get on. Thanks, Claire. Dermot. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Back to papers in a minute. I just stay with this at the moment. Go ahead. You're talking about the state of driving and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, it all starts with the education. And for the last couple of years, I've been trying to get the theory test changed. Now, the problem with the theory test is if you get 35 out of 40 right and you miss 5 questions, you've got those wrong, they don't give you the right answers. So now you're being allowed out on the road with misinformation.
Without knowing what the right answer was.
Exactly.
But yeah, okay, I understand that. So what do you want? Let's just deal with it for a second. What do you want to happen in that regard with regards to the theory test? How change it? How?
Well, if you're passing, like if you get 39 out of 40, then give you the answer to the question you got wrong, specifically. Because now you know that all the information that you have put in on your test is correct.
No, but you could go back to the manual and check the questions that you got wrong and find out what the correct answer was, couldn't you?
No, you can't, because the questions aren't available.
Okay, there's no actual bog-standard questions. But don't you think that, in spite of everything, like, it's amazing that people have to do mandatory lessons first, right? Then you have to do the driving test, which is tough enough with the people that are testing you. You also have to do a very, very tough theory test, which I've done on a number of occasions in the last 5 years, and every time I've done it, I have failed it. So the bar is very high to get a licence in Ireland, but yet, 2024, more than 60 people have died on Irish roads so far this year, and the statistics going forward are bleak, to say the least. And we have a big, big problem, particularly with young people aged between 16 and 25, killing themselves or crashing on roads. Why?
Because they're going out onto the road with the wrong information. They're not being given a chance. And like, if you get 39 out of 40, then you've got one wrong, but they're still letting you out on the road with that wrong question that you have answered, instead of giving you the answer. No, if you fail, if you get 34, go back to the manual and do the test again. But nobody is going to tell me, or is willing to tell me, why they will not give you the correct information when they're allowing you out on the road.
But common sense would tell you, put the theory test aside.
Common sense
would tell you not to be driving up the arse of a car behind you on a ring road like that, or any main road where people are doing 80 to 100 kilometres. Have they any idea about braking distance? I'm giving you just one example. Common sense.
But you see, the problem with that is that if you're out on the road and you see somebody coming up and he's tailgating or up the backside of someone else, you can ring your guard station and they'll say, oh, come on in and make a statement and we'll go to court.
I'm not talking about people reporting these dopes. I'm saying, why are these dopes driving like that? Why are they texting? Why are they holding the phone up to their ear? Why are they tailgating too tight behind the car ahead of them? You know, why aren't they using indicators? Why are they changing lanes in very, very fast traffic? Why? It's common sense should
because
dictate.
Because they can't be reported. That's why, because if you try to report somebody for something, you'll be asked to come in and make a statement, and it'll be all solicitors, it'll be all court, and people don't have that time. Whereas if they brought out that you could make a call that to say that this registration number on this date at this time was tailgating, then they may get a letter from the Gardaí or whatever, or maybe a phone call, and maybe that might calm them down.
All right.
Because there aren't enough Gardaí. They just can't do it.
Okay, thanks, Dermot. Appreciate the call. Get involved in the conversation, particularly if you were caught up this morning or have an opinion on driving and driving habits. Can I just stay with that, actually, because there are a lot of different driving-related stories making the papers today. Of course, we have the man charged with dangerous driving causing the death of the GAA commentator, Paddy Palmer. That case is continuing. And just to remind you, a copy in the mail this morning says that he admitted to his mother and his friends in text messages just hours after the collision that he had left the scene of a traffic accident drunk. This is Bohdan Berveski, a native of Ukraine, a Ukrainian who was living in Ballinhasic. He denies the dangerous driving charge causing the death of Paddy Palmer. And the Echo picks up on the copy this morning saying that he texted a friend. This is evidence in court now. He texted a friend that day describing himself as a moron, saying, I'm in the wrong 100%. I drove off. I was drunk. There is no excuse for me. I am guilty of it. And the court has heard all of this. And that's court copy from the likes of Liam Heelan and the Echo this morning. And then an awfully sad story from Wexford this morning of a woman in her mid-50s. She was killed. Her car rolled over her and pinned her underneath the car, and the neighbours found her body around midday yesterday in a little village called Castlebridge in Wexford town. Isn't that awfully tragic? And with regards to, you know, how people drive and people's behaviour, maybe we need more of a big brother nanny state in this regard. I don't know, but I was telling you yesterday that they're going to start rolling out Dublin first, then the rest of us, traffic cameras at traffic lights. But there'll be an awful lot more traffic cameras in the future. According to the Mail this morning, there will be traffic cameras that will be able to detect a mobile phone, even if it's on your lap. There will be two different cameras. One is a camera to take the registration of your car. The second camera will be on you. It will be an AI camera. It will analyze the image of you, Your body behind the wheel, it will detect if you've committed or are committing an offence. It could be not wearing a seatbelt if you're a moron. You're driving with a mobile phone up to your ear if you're a moron. All sorts of things like that. So this is all the new tech they're talking about. They're going high tech, according to this morning's Mail. It's an awfully, it's just awful to even read the story of a Cork man who was involved in the sexual abuse of a brother and a sister in foster care. Got jail yesterday for 9 years. It's a front page story making the Echo today. And then for people who are just literally trying to go about their jobs and do their work, who's finding it tough these days, do you think, to go about their business and deal with the public? TV license inspectors, because the abuse they're getting is making their jobs and their lives almost impossible. It's a front pager in The Independent this morning. In fact, Unpost was forced to stop TV license inspections and offer training to staff because of the amount of public anger they're getting over the RTE payment scandal. And increased hostility at the doorstep, verbal abuse. It doesn't talk of anything about physical abuse, but certainly the amount of verbal abuse they're getting is just gone way too far, and it's intolerable for staff. License fees, TV licenses, with regards to those who are and aren't paying. The issue, the amount of people now without any television license, the amount of fines issued for having no TV license has fallen by 40% in the last 12 months, which means that they're literally not going out knocking on doors because there's just too much grief out there. But a lot of people are still holding out and refusing to pay their license fee. You can kind of half understand why, really, can't you? Because of the carry-on, the absolutely appalling carry-on with regards to money and all sorts of side deals and shenanigans within RTE. But I actually should probably mention this because, well, Helen McEntee is going to war with regards to drivers. The same, and this needs to happen very soon. We need to toughen up our crimes and our laws with our tougher sentencing for knife crime or people in possession of a knife. You've got some kind of a yob going about there now with a knife or a blade or a Stanley knife, whatever the case may be. They could well soon face up to 7 years if they're convicted of a range of blade offences. Now, one thing is to a blade offence where you're actually using it, and of course that should have a very, very serious sentence. But I also think that there should be a sentence, some sort of a sentence for somebody stopped carrying a blade or a knife or something like that, because there'd be no good reason to have a knife or a blade on your person, of that you can be sure. Papers also this morning talk about how you're wondering how people are getting into the country without any documents. Well, that's one thing. They probably have them and are tearing them up on the plane or whatever the case may be. But others are getting in here with fake documents. And the Mail on its front and inside pages this morning talks about gangs who are pretty much acting now like travel agents. They're selling packages of fake documents to allow illegal migration into Ireland. An awful lot of it coming from Georgia, Georgian nationals, quite an amount of them male. There is no problem with regards to living in Georgia. It's not at war. It's not deemed to be a hostile country to its natives or anything like that. But yet, we've got many, many people coming in from Georgia. The last statistical year is 2022, and there was nearly just over maybe 2,700 and odd came in from Georgia illegally because they wouldn't have the proper paperwork at all. But they're getting fake driving licenses. They're getting fake ID cards. And they're coming in here then. Apparently, and you know, you can see how desperate people are to come here. They could have to pay anywhere for a package of documents, fake documents, anywhere between 8,000 and 12,000 euro on the black market. So that's one of the reasons how people are managing to get in here. The documents, they must be very good though, because a lot of the documents would be checked by scanning, wouldn't they? And you would think that they'd show up as being fake. And then a couple of stories then with regards to our pubs in Ireland. There's a pub up in Dublin. I don't know, I mean, I've spoken to pubs in the past who actually did take out Diageo products, and others then took out Heineken products in the past because of weight, because of price increases. But there's a pub up in Dublin called Kavanagh's on New Street, and they're fighting back against the Diageo price increases by banning some of their beers. Take a Hike is the headline in the Star today. And at the same time, of course, well, we're hearing about issues with regards to our pubs. More and more restaurants continue to close. So far this year, 212 restaurants. Two restaurants are closing every day in Ireland, with a tsunami of more to close across 2024. And they've been badly hit. Meanwhile, of course, we do like our drink and we do like our alcohol. We're third in the world for pubs per head of capita, which means that in all of the world, Ireland are third, with the the amount of pubs we have by virtue of the amount of people in the population. Everybody apparently is within walking distance of a pub, apparently. And I suppose to some extent that's a good thing for everybody who isn't abusing alcohol. What's wrong with it to be within walking distance of a pub? But they do talk as well this morning of the average annual consumption of alcohol in this country for all of us. It's 9.9 litres of alcohol. That would be if you took all of the actual alcohol within all of the drinks, you know, pure alcohol, it would come in at just under 10 litres of it, which is quite a lot, I suppose. It's showing the harmful and the hazardous drinking patterns that are affecting people's health. And also, we all too often forget the amount of pressure that it's putting on, you know, health-related issues is putting on our health service. Now, the hotels, of course, are looking for the VAT rate to be reduced again from 13.5% to 9%. I get that. Many people push back saying that when they had 9% instead of the higher 13%, they didn't drop prices. They didn't drop their food prices. They didn't drop their room rates. Now, that's understandable that maybe some would say, well, when you had it good, why didn't you drop and pass it on to the punter? But that's a day for a story for another day, I suppose. The one this morning is the high hotel rates in the likes of Dublin or also Cork, to be honest with you. We've often done comparisons between when there's a big event on in Cork and when there's not. The comparing prices all over the world now, particularly all over Europe. For the, like, say, for a couple of examples would be a Bruce Springsteen gig or a Taylor Swift gig, how the room rates go up. But don't feel so bad, because apparently lots of other big cities do the very same thing. So it's not as if it's an Irish greed thing. It's hoteliers right across Europe are doing it. So that's a story that makes this morning's Irish Independent. And then making many of the newspapers this morning is the Southern correspondent of Virgin Media News, Paul Byrne, because he's making the papers today and the online editions as well, because he's launched a High Court action because of an internal disciplinary procedure brought against him by his employer, Virgin Media Television. Some of the copy includes copy in the Echo this morning, which says that Paul Byrne was suspended from his role following a live report that he made on the afternoon of February 9th concerning the death of a young boy in Waterford. And his claim in court is that he was suspended after information that he gave in the broadcast, which incidentally, it's claimed, was also carried by other media outlets besides just him. But that information then subsequently turned out to be inaccurate. And at the time, he believed the information to be credible. So that's what's going on in court at the moment, and the papers are talking about it. They have a thing called the News Guidelines and Production Handbook, which has to be followed. And they claim, Virgin claim, it was a breach of the broadcaster's guidelines. So he's suing Virgin Media Television over this disciplinary action, that it should be set aside, and that he should be allowed to get on with his work. So that's been, I think that's been pushed back now for some time to give both sides an opportunity to resolve the matter. And then that's a court issue, a court battle, if you like. There are other types of battles making the papers today. Did you ever wonder what animal on the entire planet that we live in has now been crowned? What's the toughest animal out there? You might think it was a lion or a tiger or a gorilla or something like that. It's not actually. It's an elephant. It's a great story making the Sun this morning. Here's what they did. They took artificial intelligence and they created a battle between all of the big species. Like they all went to war against each other. The African elephant, the Siberian tiger, the crocodile, the hippopotamus, the leopard, the shark, the polar bear, you know, the great white shark, even the colossal squid. You know, all of them could do damage if they got a hold of you. But apparently, in that battle, the elephant, time after time after time, in these virtual fights, won out in the end. So that's the great thing about artificial intelligence. You can create these things and you can mock them up to look real. There's an alarming story on the BBC yesterday of a woman. I only came across the conversation halfway through it, so I actually don't know who she was. But apparently, somebody within artificial intelligence took her head and her shoulders, right? And they plonked her head on the body of another woman. It probably was the body of a porn star. So you had a private individual, a private citizen, engaged in pornography and sex, like in a porn video, unbeknownst to them, and it looked so real, and it's up online for everybody to see, and she's absolutely distraught about it. That's the downside to AI, isn't it? Text 0868104106.
Call Neil now. 0818104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
All right, already two very bad crashes this morning. Now a third one, another one on Maryborough Hill, just past the roundabout heading towards Carrigaline. I just don't get it, guys. I've calls on this one, but there is a report out on rising road deaths in Ireland, and we are bucking the trend for all the wrong reasons. Last year was the worst in nearly a decade, with over 188 deaths, and we're definitely going to surpass that if things continue. We're in the month of April, 60 dead already. As recently as 5 years ago, Ireland was being celebrated within the EU for road safety because we got our fatalities down by over 40%, but that has completely changed. And you have to say, it's driving, it's the driver's habits. Now, some of it has to do with our crazy roads. You know, I know, I get that, secondary roads and country roads and things like that, and the state of our roads, God knows, the potholes and the craters and the sinkholes, they're not the best, but you have to take into consideration all of those things as a driver, don't you? But it appears to be getting worse. I was reading a report on it earlier in the week that Primetime put together. I was reading the actual document report on it. 61 people had died in the roads in 2024. A third were 25 years old or younger. So you have a problem with young people. 80% of the people between the age of 16 and 25 who died on our roads since 2023 were male drivers. So if you have a problem with young drivers, and you have a big problem with young male drivers, apparently. I'll go back to calls in a few minutes' time. If you look at the road deaths per million across Europe, we are the worst. Many, many countries are reducing their road deaths year on year. Spain, Portugal, Austria, France, Luxembourg, all of them are down. Even like if you look at places like Poland, Cyprus, they've reduced their road deaths by like 35%. Ours have gone up between 2017 and 2019 by 30%. Norway's has gone up as well, and another one or two, but nobody has had an increase like we have. Why is that? Is it the state of our roads? Is it driver habits? Is there drink involved in it? Is there drugs involved in it? The director of the Medical Bureau of Road Safety up in UCD said, drink driving remains the very serious concern as a contributory factor to road traffic crash accidents. Now, the survey indicates it's becoming more socially acceptable to drink and drive again. Hard to believe that, isn't it? The survey suggests that it's becoming more socially acceptable to drink and drive again. 37% of all driver fatalities between 2015 and 2019 tested positive for drink. Nearly 40% of the fatalities involved drink. And of those fatalities where alcohol was detected, the dead were typically male and under the age of 45, right? These deaths generally occurred in the late evening or the early hours of the morning, and also a lot at weekends. So the prevalence of drink driving is still with us. You know, one would have thought that would have been really a thing of the past. It isn't. Two other issues, cannabis and cocaine, are also turning up an awful lot in positive tests. Cannabis, half of the time, and cocaine, 27% of the time. So they look at like 7,500 people arrested and detained on the suspicion of not drink in their system, but drugs in their system. So not just alcohol, but throw into the mix all sorts of different drugs, including cannabis and cocaine. And of course, can't forget the big elephant in the room here, speeding, the other major factor in road fatalities. Statistics showing a disproportionately prevalent in the deaths of male drivers. So in layman's terms, it means that male drivers, particularly younger ones, are driving too fast. And nearly 90% of drivers killed on roads while driving above the appropriate speed limit. And would you believe that 80% of those who were speeding were male? I know I'm blinding you with an awful lot of statistics. It's all bad news, and it's destined to get a hell of a lot worse. I have no idea why we're bucking the trend in Europe, and I don't know why more often now than ever before we're hearing of crashes and deaths and issues on our roads. Thank you to everybody who's been sending me texts and photographs from their journey, their stalled journey this morning. Here's one that sums it up then for everybody else who's obeying and doing what they're supposed to do behind the wheel. Just started work, new job, Monday morning gone, and I have a really important meeting that started 10 minutes ago. But here I am, sat on the dual carriageway. I could literally cry. So that's the impact on other people then who get it right. Peter Walsh is the owner of Karting World in Watergrass Hill. He's got some thoughts to share on all of this. Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Prendeville. How are you, sir?
What do you make of it? Because you can talk all you want about, you know, state of the roads and the potholes and the amount of cars there, but this is all down to driver error in one shape or form or another, isn't it?
It is. Well, I used to be actually a former professional race driver myself, so I've been in very in tune with, you know, the behaviours of a racing driver and people driving on the road, etc. And it's got to a stage where it felt like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, you know, it kind of felt like when we got out of coronavirus that it was almost people were rusty on the roads, if that makes any sense.
Do you think? I never thought of that. Good point.
Yeah, it kind of like, it's almost like people lost their mojo, their confidence. Do you know what I mean? And it's still a little bit around, you know, whereas, as you were saying just a little while ago, that people are driving right up your rear end and, you know, all these accidents you're just mentioning on the radio. It's just, it's gone a bit crazy at the moment. It's hard to know, just finger exactly what's going on.
Okay, I'll add that to the list of issues then, that COVID made people forget how to drive.
I wouldn't say forget how to drive. I think it's
rusty.
More just a little bit rusty, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that because people were locked away for how many weeks and end, you know, and you couldn't remember that. If you remember that 2 kilometre distance we had, you couldn't, you know, you could only go for a walk for a while. So, you know, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, but it just kind of felt like that to me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you see, this morning, and I'm kind of even slow to reference it, but I came across this one, and the cars involved in it were all up very close and tight in the crash. There was at least 3 of them were backed up on top of each other. Surely be to God, yeah. Peter Walsh, that's people driving too close, no?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, coming from a race and driving background, you'd be very conscious of safety. Right, because you know, if you have a bad accident in a racing car, it could be your life gone. Mm. So a lot of racing drivers, well, I would say actually 99.9% of us are extremely careful when we're on the road because we know of the dangers of, you know, there's other people around you. You know, you're not in complete control, and it doesn't mean that people are bad drivers or not. It's just there's other people coming, you know, straight towards you on the other side of the road. And it can be tough. So the safety aspect is very, very good. To be conscious of that.
Okay, that's great for professional race drivers. But is it a case then that the 16 to 25-year-old males think they're racing drivers and behave firstly like as if they're professional drivers and secondly that they're invincible and they're never going to die? What is their problem?
I just think it's a lack of, I suppose, knowing that there's danger, that you can, like, you know, even when I was 16, 17, there was that sort of, you know, you think you're invincible, etc. But I suppose when you get into a racing car, you know all about it once you have your first big crash. But
okay,
that's the problem, man. That's why I was calling this morning, actually, because...
Let me just stay with that point before you move on to another one.
Sure.
Why then, this might sound absolutely mad, but why then, as part of somebody's learning to drive, you have to do the theory test, you have to take your lessons, and then you have to do the driving test itself. Why don't we have everybody who's learning to drive being required to sit into a simulator, a car simulator, and crash at high speed?
And with the simulator, as in give them a feel of...
Correct.
Actually, oh,
so you're in a simulator, you have a car, you're driving it, you're involved in a crash, it could be a head-on, could be a pole, could be a tail, you know, you could ram up the arse of somebody else's car, but you get the impact of it and you're in almost like a real-life scenario where you are in a simulated crash. Everyone who experiences something like that will never forget it.
It's a good idea. what I would say from my own experience, because when I used to race now, I used to race in simulators as well. Like, for instance, if I was going to a new track now, there was even when I was back in my day, I was playing PlayStation 1 and I was going to the Formula 1 track Spa-Francorchamps. Now, PlayStation 1 is an old computer, right? So it's not even a full simulator. But it gave me a really good idea of how the flow of the track was, where I was going, the rhythm. Now, at the same time, if you have a crash in a simulator or a computer game, you still know that it's not real. Do you know what I mean?
No, like, it's not real. So I'm saying, simulate something to give somebody an opportunity to experience what it would be really like in the event of a collision, a serious collision. Surely,
I would say if you could get to that stage, that level where it's so real that it's, whoa, that'd be great.
You're not going to see that in a PlayStation game, right? You are not going to see that either, say, for instance, on Grand Theft Auto. You're never going to be experience the actual impact of a crash, you know, because you just you reboot and you keep... Well, they're just games.
Exactly, but I think that's where it's the issue could still possibly lie, that even back in those days, the technology wasn't great, but the technology's advanced so much now that even simulators can get to a degree where it feels so real now that it's, you still know that it's not real, do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I've been in a simulator when I went to... I've been in a simulator, well, this would be more, you know, the VDR, the, you know, you put on the goggles and the headset, went down in a cage... Right. Under the sea, I'm inside in the cage, and then I'm attacked, and the cage is attacked by a great white shark. I tell you what, I thought it was damn serious at the time when it was happening. I thought I was going to die. I thought he was going to get in and just tear me apart.
Really?
Yeah, you know, VR can be that realistic. You know, I'm just wondering how we're going to improve things and get people to slow down, particularly young people. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you that, I mean, like, things are getting better and they're getting more realistic as we go on. Even, isn't it the metaverse now? Facebook, they're bringing out these things, that you look to VR, etc. Like, some of the racing simulators are realistic.
Use that technology if it's going to make a difference and save lives. But anyway, you wanted to make a point. You started some kind of a driving school, though, did you?
We have. We've given it a soft launch for now. We're just sort of getting our feet wet with it now. So basically, we have a new driving academy up at the in Cartworld in Watergrass Hill. And it's basically, we've got three cars now that you can rent. And it allows people to not drive on the road and drive in a safe environment in our area. And at least then, you know, you can build your confidence, changing gears up and down, using the clutch, you know, three pedals. We'll also show people how to change the oil levels in the car, the windscreen fluid, the do tire pressures, etc. So you're learning the basics even before you get on the road. And there's been a great response to it now. We're limited with bookings at the moment. So we're just, again, we're getting our feet wet with it. But it's the response now we've had so far has been brilliant.
What's the age profile?
15 and up.
Okay. You can get further details where? Are you on, you're online, obviously, Karting World?
Adventure Park at Cartworld Watergrass Hill, yeah. And nice. But they can also call us as well on 021-488-9477, and they can ask for more information. But yeah, a lot of our information is on social media as well.
Okay,
Facebook,
my man.
TikTok, okay. Instagram.
Okay.
So hopefully we can build people's confidence with that.
Thanks for taking the call. As always, Peter Walsh from Karting World in Watergrass Hill. Hold on there, Rachel. I'll get to you after the break. Pick up the phone, 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Traffic is still very badly backed up, right up to the tunnel, all the way back to Carrick Tool. Still people trying to get to the tunnel that's in going from east to west. And of course, it's not helped by other dopes then using the hard shoulder, trying to get up along in the hard shoulder, creating an extra lane of traffic. So people still get in touch with me by text all the way back to Carrick Tool and what have you. Such are the delays. Text 0868 104 106. The impatience of people. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How
Thank
are you?
Thank you so much for taking the call. Share the story you have with regards to your husband who came across a woman on the road. Go ahead.
Yeah, so my husband and son, my son is 12, they were coming home last night and they came across a woman on her own on the Dunkettle roundabout and she was broken down. So her story was her car was in the garage, her own car, and this was like a loaner car or a rental car she'd gotten from the garage and it had broken down on the roundabout. So my husband came across her, he pulled in behind her and he put the little triangle thing up behind the car. And he said he was actually horrified at the amount of people that passed her, slowed down, looked at her, beat at her, shouted at her out the window and sped off.
Shouting what? You know, well, like shouting what?
Just get out of the way. I don't know, I wasn't there. I didn't hear it. Or, you know, just being generally rude to her. And sure, look, she was
oh, yeah, it's like, she was, oh, no, I'm terribly sorry. I'm just stopping here to have a flask of tea and a sandwich.
Yeah. I'm just parked on the roundabout for the crack. Yeah, my son was 12 he was horrified. He said, Mom, he said, every second person that passed slowed down, looked, they were causing the backup for slowing down, looked at her, beeped at her, shouted at her and off they went. Shame on them. I mean, look, when you're in your car, you're not invisible. You can be seen through the window. I think people think when they're driving their car that they can't be seen. You can be seen. People can see what you're doing, you know. So, and a lot of time, people leave too late. They're always in a hurry. You know, if you want to be there wherever you're going on time, leave on time. You know, allow for things like this to happen.
Yeah.
I just thought it was horrendous. My son thought it was horrendous and he's only 12, you know.
The aggression of people. The aggression of them.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah, and it was like, it was half past 9 at night. It's not like it was rush hour and she was stopping everybody going to work. You know, the traffic would have been fairly, you know, slow or, you know, fairly light.
Did your husband say that the whole experience upset the woman? Was she shook from it, like?
Oh, she was. She was giving my poor son money and everything. She, God love her. Like, she was horrified. And she, look, she wasn't even there that long. It was 15 minutes before the tow truck came and took her away. I think it was the battery that was the problem in the car or something. But, you know, for my son and husband to witness that and that poor woman to go through that, if they hadn't stopped, Joe said, nobody was going to stop for her.
And of course, you know, none of them ever looked at it. She'd have been, she just got lucky with your husband and your son. Did a tow truck arrive eventually then, Yeah.
They came. But what if she was on her own with a baby in the car? You know, I just think, you know, I don't know. People just don't care anymore.
Where is the kindness and the consideration? I mean, it's 9:30 at night. Like, what rush are people in and where are they going? Yeah. It's not drive time or anything like that, you know? It's not as if they got to be... It's different, I get it. Like, this morning, people have, you know, all been discommoded, like, really and truly, because, again, of driving habits. But it just goes to show, you know, slowing down, speeding, shouting abuse and driving on. It's bad enough as it is to be stuck in a scenario like that, isn't it? Well done to your husband, though. Fair play.
I know. But look, if people actually watched where they were going and stopped looking at the accident as well, they might prevent further backups. Like, all they were looking out, they were driving forward and looking at the accident.
There's a lot of rubbernecking. You know? Yeah, it's almost, I understand what you mean. It's a human condition. We all tend to want to take a look. We know we shouldn't, but it's kind of human nature. It doesn't help the matter. Good stuff. Well done. Thanks, Rachel. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. One of the more crazier things that can happen as you drive. It's not crazy, but it's actually quite funny what people do. I had to drive up to the Glen to drop off a car up to Dave Kelleher, the mechanics, yesterday up in the Glen, and traffic was quite heavy. I had to. I was coming up by St. Luke's, and actually, cut a long story short, I needed to find an ATM. Did you ever notice how few ATMs there are around when you actually might need one? It's amazing. I know that the banks are closing branches, but you would think that there would be lots of money. Anyway, there wasn't. So I drove up into St. Luke's, up the hill, up Summerhill North, right? And then I hooked a left. St. Luke's just a beautiful village. It's just a gorgeous place. There's a great little shop there. It's kind of like a big shop deli, and they do all sorts of wonderful organic fruits and veg and ready-to-go foods and things like that. It's super shop. Don't know what the name of it is. It's on the left-hand side. But I just drove up to the top there by the toll booth, the old toll booth, and turned left, right? And then there was a car in front of me that was stopped. Now, there was oncoming traffic and everything, and I was saying, oh, yeah, this is right in the middle of the road now. It wasn't, like, parked on the side or up on the footpath. The car was just stopped in the middle of the road, so I was stopped behind it, and all of the other traffic was coming down, and I was saying, well, he or she is doing the right thing, you know, letting the traffic pass, and then he's going to carry on. It was a bit tight. So I waited there. What felt like, I don't know, must have been maybe 60 seconds, 90 seconds, nothing happening. I'm very, very slow to beep, you know, but there was no oncoming traffic anymore. And I was saying, sure, this guy or woman, whoever it is probably texting on the phone or their head down, and they don't realise that it's okay now to proceed. So I just did a quick beep, you know, beep. Nothing. I'm sitting there wondering, why won't they drive on? What's going on? Eventually, I realised I'm just going to have to pass the person myself. So I reversed the car and just drove around it and was passing the car to realise that there was nobody in it. It was an empty car. She's gone off to do a bit of shopping or whatever and just abandoned the car in the middle of the road. Firstly, I felt like a right moron for not realising. You couldn't see through the back window, it was tinted or something, that the car was actually empty. I mean, the crazy things you come across while driving, isn't it true? Anyway, text 0868104106. I'll do a whole bunch of texts on this just after 10 o'clock. But if I could just take a couple of seconds, if you don't mind, just to clarify something. The last few days, I've been looking at a story regarding Ukrainian refugees down in Yall, primarily in the Quality Hotel. There's a lot of talk going on in Yall, and it is a lot of talk. People are discussing it at the moment. You could call it a rumour, if you like, that all of the Ukrainian refugees that are down in the hotel rooms or the apartments or the holiday homes within the Quality Hotel are being moved to places like Mayo and are being moved to places like Sligo, and that all of those rooms then, and apartments and holiday homes and hotel bedrooms, there's 125 in total, there's 25 hotel rooms, there's 48 two-bed apartments, and there's 52 holiday homes that can take up to three or four different beds. So you're talking about, at one stage there was 800 guests there. I think it's down to 600 now. So there is availability to take in more. But anyway, there was talk that they were all being moved. Many are working locally in the community. A lot of school-going children there. Some are going to college and they've settled in. And there was a lot of concern with regards to the Ukrainian refugees and the citizens in Yall, because they were being told that the refugees from Ukraine were all being moved up to West, and they were going to be replaced then in the Quality Hotel by International Protection Order males. So there was a lot of concern over this. And in spite of contacting a lot of TDs and a lot of local councillors, they couldn't help with the story at all. We spent 3 or 4 days back and forth. At one stage, even Seamus Whelan called into the hotel and could not get any response from the hotel in any way, shape or form, either by email or by phone or in person. So we were getting nowhere on this story, even though the rumours are rife down in Yall. And then this morning, we did finally manage to get in touch with the hotel group that owns and manages the hotel at a higher level. So the group has confirmed now that they have no intention of relocating Ukrainian refugees from the property. They say the Ukrainian model is the original model operating within the hotel. They told us there are under 700 Ukrainians at Red Barn, and that those 700, maybe a little less than 700, that they will be staying. They say there are some spaces vacant for International Protection Order arrivals, and they say we can only take what the department sends us. So that, to me, when you read it, means that they will be taking International Protection Order guests, if you like. Now, as to where they will be from or who they are, how many will be male and female, I do not know. But all I can tell you at this point in time is the Ukrainian families with children, etc., etc., who are there will be staying there. And that's been confirmed to us by the hotel. As to who is arriving, that's not 100% clear. The group that owns the hotel say they will take only what the department send, and they're obliged to take what the department sends. So we'll have to wait and see what happens in that regard. You can get involved in this conversation if you wish. Text 0868 104 106, but no more than that. I was talking with them, you know, we talk about the, have I time for this? Yeah, I do. I was talking yesterday with a girl from Ukraine, Kate, and I was chatting about, you know, life in living in the Quality Hotel and living in Yall and stuff. I played that for you at some stage, the interview with her. But at one point I asked her, because there's €1 million a month being spent on Ukrainian cats, the pets of Ukrainians, cats and dogs, like 12 million a year. It's a shameful figure. It's just a disgraceful amount of money. It's disgraceful that we're paying this money at all in the first place. So I said, how many cats and dogs do you think, would you estimate, or in the quality hotel in Yall? Are there, is like, there must be loads of them all over the place, because they're taking like maybe 700-800 refugees down there. Do you think there'd be maybe 100 or 150 cats and dogs or whatever? She said maybe 8 or 10. Maybe 8 or 10, a dozen at a push. So where are all of these cats and dogs? Back after 10, text 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
I know that it's a little on the early side, but yesterday I gave away some tickets to Bryan Adams and his gig down at Live at the Marquee. Today I want to give away tickets for Damien Dempsey. I'm a huge fan of Damien Dempsey. I just love his music. I love his stage presence. I love his interaction. He's a big, huge guy. I had him in studio, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, 7, maybe even 10 years ago was the last time he was in studio. And his presence in a studio with the guitar is like, it's right up there with the likes of your Christy Moores or your Bob Dylan's. He's just fabulous. So he's playing the Marquee on Saturday, the 8th of June. We have a double ticket to give away. I know it's early. I give away loads more across May and June. Don't you worry about that. I'll have lots of tickets to give away for the Marquee. But Damien Dempsey's song, sometime between now and midday, caller 9 wins on 0818 104 106. And we'll do the same again tomorrow with Van Morrison tickets. So an opportunity to scoop those as well. So text 0868 104 106. Pick up the phone on 0818 104 106. Lots then. Just bear with me, because I want to also do other things this morning. I want to go back to that relationship breakdown email that we dealt with yesterday. Got a massive response on that, with regards to your own thoughts on it. And also I want to share a conversation, or at least I want Laura to have an opportunity to share her conversation, her life. I recently spoke to Laura, who escaped a very emotionally abusive relationship, and it took a lot of courage to walk away. So she has a very interesting story to tell. But let's just stay with the events of this morning. And these are just becoming far too frequent now. And of course, there's loss of life. You know, there really is. There's fatalities, and then people have life-changing injuries. And, you know, listen, it could be your wife, it could be your mother, it could be your father, it could be your husband, your wife, your partner that's involved in a crash that's not of their making. There are crashes on that section of the roadway every other morning. It's people who are late for work and speeding in built-up areas. Okay, I'll take that on board. Just because people put on their indicators to merge doesn't mean they have the right to pull out, you know. There's some crazy driving standards, and yet it's more important to learn X and Y in school when kids getting practical driving skills is far more important in my eyes. Interesting point. Maybe it should be mandatory. Maybe some schools do it already. Theory, or indeed some kind of, courses or lessons on driving. Tell the chap to download the NDLS app for the theory test. It'll give you the wrong answers explained. You're right. Everything to do with our roads is common sense. And I can practically guarantee you that the majority of these accidents are to do with devices and distraction. Yes, they are major players. Not exclusively that, but they are major players. Driving too close, driving too fast, thinking you're invincible. The driving test is an embarrassment. No motorway driving, for instance. No nighttime driving. There should be a 10-session continuous assessment set up that makes up 10 hours, where you get an average score. Not 1 hour driving around Toker, for God's sake. My wife recently passed her test. She is insured on my car, and she is still not ready to drive on her own, in spite of passing her test. She wants to get a car, and even when she does, she will still only drive with me in the car until she is ready to be on her own. Do you mind me asking who's saying that? Is you telling me that's how your wife feels about it, or how you feel about her driving? The theory test is nothing at all to do with our problems and crashes. That fellow Dermot is not is ridiculous. Well, he has a point of view which he's entitled to. The theory test is part of it. It's not the practical aspect of it. Of course, that is the lessons and the test itself. But you need to know the rules of the road. Yeah, I mean, the theory test is important. Otherwise, you won't know what signs mean. Think about it. If we had a Garda presence on our roads, it would certainly help. Not a Garda to be seen anymore. I'm glad you raised this. I spoke to the inspector yesterday on this very matter. By the way, it's not always young people. It's most of the time, but not always young people. My son was knocked down before Christmas on a crossing. I'm totally appalled at the way this carry-on is left go on and people are being killed. Imagine that. Your son was knocked down. When you say a crossing, I'm assuming your son was knocked down at a zebra crossing, where you would feel so safe crossing a road, wouldn't you? There was an accident heading east on the same stretch of road this morning. Ah, right. Okay, so there was one heading east also, as opposed to three crashes heading west. There is no doubt that all of these is because of rubbernecking. In France, you'd have the police a mile down the road from an accident waving cars on and encouraging them to speed up to stop all of this carry-on rubbernecking. About the many crashes we're having lately, has anyone asked the question, how many accidents happened because of careless driving from people who used to drive on the other side of the road, perhaps from other countries? They have very different rules in the countries that they're fleeing from, but that question might not be allowed to be asked in this country anymore. I can't answer that. I mean, I wouldn't know unless we're, you know, hearing of, you know, the after effects, maybe the involvement of a court case or something like that. They should post a squad car at the tunnel in the morning rush hour to get them all to slow down. Somebody sent me another video there a while ago of crazy driving within the tunnel. I'll come back to it a little later on. It involves a car in the right-hand lane driving too slow. So you have loads of cars behind it who then decide that in the middle of the tunnel, what they're going to do is they are going to... you're not supposed to overtake in the tunnel, right? You just aren't. So the car in front is driving too slow, like crawling along in the tunnel. So your man behind decides that he's going to pull into the left-hand lane of the tunnel, overtake, and slip back in very quickly in a tiny little space back into the right-hand lane again. Oh, sure, everything's fine. She's indicated out and he's indicated back in. It's like as if everything's right. But in another split second, that car that was doing the overtaking would have clipped the front of the car that was driving too slowly, would have flipped, and then you've had a multiple crash inside in the tunnel. It's amazing when you see the video, you can see how easily these things happen. Anyway, there's reams of these texts. I'll come back to them throughout the course of the morning. I promise I will. But yesterday, I read about a situation where a husband and wife's relationship has completely and utterly hit the skids now. It's come to a block. They have children together. They were not living together for many years. They were in a relationship, but, you know, together 15 years, but only living together 2 years. And since they moved in together, everything has changed. She has noticed how selfish and self-centered he's become. She says, I'm the stay-at-home mum by choice because we couldn't pay all of the different fees for me to go to work. But my husband doesn't think I need any me time. He says, why would you need me time? You're home all day. I'm not going to read out the entire email again. She says, I'm lost now and I don't really know where to go. I have no friends, very few hobbies, fell out of touch with an awful lot of people. He thinks that, you know, his idea for me of getting a break is that I go out to do the food shopping and that should be enough. He doesn't help in any way, shape or form, incidentally. He doesn't do any cooking or cleaning or laundry or shopping or school runs or nothing. I have no patience for this man myself, even though a counsellor was telling me yesterday that we need to look at it through the prism of his eyes. Why? Like, why? He's just a selfish man. Anyway, that prompted a lot of calls and texts yesterday. I want to return to that after the break. I spoke recently to Laura, who escaped a very emotionally abusive relationship a few years back. Her story is next. Thank you.
Call Neil now. 0818-104-106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
So listen, it's an extraordinary story, and clearly it's a story of coercive control, gaslighting, shockingly intense relationship for all the wrong reasons. But I know that this individual was married before, right?
That's correct.
And then started wooing you. But you were saying that there were red flags from the beginning. What were they?
Yeah, so the first one was, you know, when I met him, he had a family already. I made it very clear that I didn't want to get involved in a relationship with him. I said, you know, I don't want to be with anybody that has kids. I was single at the time. I didn't have kids. I was very young. I was carefree. I was, you know, living a good life. It was always my thing where I'm not getting involved with somebody that has kids already.
I get that. And that life that you were leading was overseas. I'm not going to identify where overseas, but you were overseas on an adventure, of course, and working away and everything.
So for 2 years, it was almost like a friendship. And because I refused to get romantically involved, and I kept saying no to that. And eventually, after 2 years, I did get involved with him romantically. And it was, you know, everything was amazing. It was like surprises and birthday surprises, and you know, I was just wowed. I really was. I was like, this is just phenomenal. You know, this guy is at the last minute. He'd do a surprise trip, and you know, he'd say, you know, just pack your bags and be ready to go. And I was just, you know, of course, I was young. I was, you know, like, you know, that kind of stuff, I suppose, was a big thing for me. And then from there, it kind of, I suppose, you know, it went very quickly from, okay, we started a romantic relationship now. And then suddenly one day I got a message with pictures of this house, and he was like, I found us a house, you know, we should move in together. And I had my own apartment at the time. I wasn't ready to, you know, to go that far yet. But this house was, again, amazing. And, you know, I did what I needed to do financially. I had a very, very good job at the time. And I did what I needed to do financially. And we ended up buying a house together, and we moved in together.
So that relationship started while he was still with his family, or had he left his family for you before the relationship started?
He'd never left. I suppose one thing for my father and my mother was, like, the red flag for them was, he's left very young children. What's going on there? And for me, I suppose, I believed what he told me in regards to reasons that he left. And when I was relaying that information to my family back home, like, now they tell me that back then they were like, this is ridiculous. Like, yeah, that just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Like, you don't leave a young family for that reason, you know?
But a lot of it made an awful lot of sense subsequently, much later on, I'd imagine. But so, yes. So you met, yes, and you got romantically involved and financially involved. You bought a home together in the early noughties. Was that a happy time?
There were happy times, Neil. So we did a lot of travel. We were back and forth to Ireland a lot, and we would, you know, we travelled all over Europe. There were times that it was amazing, but there was always, every country we visited, I can honestly say that if I ever go back to that country now, I can remember exactly. It's like the triggers came up for me, and the bad memories of, you know, what happened in that particular country and how awful it was, because there was always something to spoil an event or a holiday or.
And what was that liable to be?
It started small, so it would be things like I learned very quickly in this relationship, and I'd never experienced this before, but I learned very quickly what it was like to walk on eggshells. And I never knew any, you know, of the terminology associated with this type of behavior before. But looking back now, I know exactly what I was doing. I became a shadow of myself. I changed, you know, how I would say things, the way I would say them, the, you know, how I would approach a conversation. Because if you said the wrong thing, or if you, like, it was really living on eggshells. You said the wrong thing and there'd be an explosion. And then the explosion would turn into the silent treatment. That was the biggest thing for me, Neil, and that was the thing that really had an effect on me mentally during the, before we were married, when we were married, and then obviously, you know, when children came along, it was the silent treatment. And then what would happen is I would get myself into a situation where I'd go panicky, almost going, why aren't you speaking to me? What the And then he would start, and he'd start saying things like, look at you, what are you hyper about? What are you crying about? What's the matter with you? And then he'd get the video camera out. And that's when I knew then there was something not right. His phone always came out to video me, and he would video me and say, oh my God, look at the condition of you. You're crying. What are you crying for? Wait till I show your brothers this. And it was, I suppose that was the start of that type of behavior. And then it got worse from there. So then we'd come back to a place of a good place again. And it would always be, I'm really sorry about my behavior. I'm going to look into my behavior. I'm going to go and see somebody about my behavior. And that was, honestly, Neil, I feel so stupid, because sometimes I look back and I say, you know, why did I not walk away at that point? Well, and then I went down the road and I got married when this was going on, you know?
So did you feel that everything would be okay if and when you got married and became a couple in the true sense of the world, as in a married couple, that everything would be okay?
I did, Neil. I honestly did. Deep down, I said, you know what? When we get married, maybe things will change. But in the lead up to us getting married, I suppose, things like my friends are a big part of my life, and I had a massive circle of friends, and the jealousy around the friends. You know, if I said I was going somewhere with my friends, that would be the silent treatment. My family came to visit from Ireland, And, you know, if we said, you know, there was a particular incident where, you know, he couldn't come with us to a particular place, we were going on a bit of an adventure for the day and he couldn't come for work commitments, but then he shut down from me, from my parents. I was mortified. Like, I came from very kind of a stable family, I would call it. My mom and dad have been together for 50, 60 years, whatever. Yeah. And I wasn't used to it, and neither were they. So I suppose for them, that was their real insight into what was actually going on in my life when they came to visit. Because, and my dad said to me one day, he said, "You can't live like this," because he experienced it firsthand. He was like, the guy, we came home after this adventure and he was sitting on the couch and he just wouldn't talk to us. He just ignored the three of us in our house. And it was so uncomfortable. It was embarrassing, and I was trying to justify it. I was saying, look, he told me about issues he's had as a kid, and, you know, it's his background. And I was constantly trying to protect him, and because I knew I was going to marry him. And
you wanted to change him, I suppose, yeah? You wanted to fix him.
I thought he would, you know, I kept saying, you know, I always try and see the good Neil in people. I always try and, you know, there must be a good side here. You know, something is good here, surely. And there were moments where people would say to me, wow, what a life you had. And I put these pictures on Facebook because I traveled all over and we went everywhere together, but people didn't know like what was going on those travels. Even there was always moments of like horrific moments of you know, abuse and just
okay. So more than the silent treatment, like abuse is a very strong word because it can be emotional, psychological, but it can also be physical.
Yes, absolutely. So there was, at the time, there was no physical abuse. There would be a lot of holes in walls. I've had more walls patched up in my house, in houses that we went to, in hotel rooms. And there was a lot of that. And I suppose, again, you know, more red flag, a lot of rage, you know, because there was many times where I said, I can't do this anymore. I have to. And any time I said that I'm leaving is when it escalated into something just really, really massive. The biggest thing for me, I suppose, was, you know, starting to isolate myself from my friends, because that was easier, and then putting up with what I was getting when I came home. My friends saw through it, and they say that to this day. They say we knew, you know, that he just, there was something not right. Eventually, I never even went out. I was kind of pulling back on that. Even my work, I was questioned about my work if I went out, and again, it was just jealousy. And I suppose the one thing that I will say is that I never, ever was unfaithful. Like in my marriage, I was so, you know, faithful in every aspect. And I just became a shadow of who I was. I was treading on eggshells. Every time I walked in the door, I didn't know what kind of reception I was going to get. And my adrenals were just shot because I was constantly in fight or flight mode, not knowing what was going to happen on the other side.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the description of him as you describe him now, but that was the complete opposite to the earlier days, you know, where he, you know, where you did eventually, you know, start a relationship with him. And I guess you fell in love with him in the early days. They're like, you're describing two different people.
Yeah. It's like, and in the early days, it was just he would do everything. It was like, you know, I'd go out with my friends and he would just go, "Oh, where are you? I'll come and collect you. I'll be outside." And he'd sit outside waiting for me. And I thought that was a lovely thing. And looking back now, I know exactly what it was. But okay, at the time,
many of these are signs, of course, of control, which could be already you've described isolating you from family and from friends. You know, corrupting your relationships with other people, very much controlling. It could even be who you see and where you go and the time. You know, this gaslighting about your mental, it's all your fault, why are you crying? That's classic gaslighting, you know?
Oh, and it was like, you know, you said you were going to this restaurant with your friends, and I was like, oh, I know, but I changed my mind at the last minute. And then I'll never forget, that was another incident, and it was just like, so, but why did you tell me you were going to that restaurant? I said, because the girls changed their mind. And he was like, and that became something that went on for nearly a week of, oh, it was just like, it was just horrendous. I thought I'm going mental here. And then he would do things like, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. Yeah. And it was, he'd make me, I felt I was actually going mad.
Yeah, that's mind. Part of it. Yeah. You end up doubting your own sanity, I suppose, don't you?
Yes.
But so that was tracking and monitoring your movements then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it was a change of plan, I knew it was all over. And I would say to my parents, if we ever came home on holiday, And I'd say, whatever you do, guys, don't change your plan. Like, if we're like you, Irish people are like that. One minute they're going one place, and the next minute they're going somewhere else. And I'd say to them, guys, can you please not change your plan? Because he'll get really upset about this. And they were looking at me going, are you for real? You know, and I was like, no, just please don't. And I'd always try and keep the peace. I was, oh, I was just living a life of eggshells. Watch what I say. Watch what I do.
Yeah, yeah. I've been reading a lot about, you know, situations like yours. No two are the same. But one thing that's in common with many people, that it's actually hard to break away from a controlling, from a, let's say, hard to break away from a controlling gaslighter, because you become ultra dependent upon them in the end. Because, of course, because your, you know, your self-esteem is gone. Your confidence is gone, you know?
Oh, I was probably one of the most confident people. Thankfully, I'm back to where I used to be now, but I was probably one of the most confident people. Everyone used to comment on that. You're so strong, you're confident, blah, blah, blah. And then I became just a shadow of myself.
So he was jealous of every aspect of your life and all of the people within your life. How did it happen? How did it go for you then when you had a couple of very small children by him? He was the dad.
Yeah. The minute my first child came along, I saw it straight away. It was the questioning, why are you breastfeeding for that long? It doesn't take that long to breastfeed. Surely it doesn't take that long. And just that kind of stuff, and just putting pressure on me. And, you know, baby was only a week old, and, you know, how come you're not working? You know, why aren't you working? You should be working now. You know, he's a week old now.
Working what? Going back to work, is it?
Yeah, like a lot of my work I could do from a laptop, so I was able to do it from home. But I wasn't in the right mind. I suffered severe postnatal depression, and again, I was told you don't have depression, you don't have postnatal depression. My family were my rock at that time. They came down, and they were there for me. I was never supposed to have my children here. I was supposed to have them abroad. But again, that was just something else. We came home once and he sprung it on me in front of my parents and said, oh, we're going to have the baby here in Ireland. And I looked and I went, I had everything sorted, you know, abroad in my home, because that was my home. And then everything was sorted for the baby to be born there. And it got sprung upon me that, oh no, we're going to stay here now.
Yeah, classic control again, you know, springing that on you. As in, I'm the dominant one here. I'm in control. I will always maintain dominance. And the sooner you get used to it, the better. But why wasn't somebody in your life, and I know I don't mean to guilt you on this, but a family member or friends, why weren't they screaming at you to get away from this man?
I know, Neil, and it's funny because some of my very good friends now look at it and they say to me, we knew, like they didn't want to, because what I wasn't telling anybody. I was protecting. I was constantly protecting him. Everything was about, you know, no, look, he, you know, he's had a bit of a messed up childhood, and, you know, this is what happened with his parents, and this is why, and he's explained to me, and he's going to get... I was constantly protecting him because I didn't want it to fail. I thought, this can be okay. But I knew I'll never go against my gut again, because my gut at the time was telling me this is just not right. I'm just going back to the, you asked me about when the kids came along, I suppose. You know, postnatal depression, I probably went through that for quite some time, and there was zero support there because the attention then became about me. So my parents are just absolutely amazing, and they were always there for me during that time. And again, the jealousy came. It was, you know, the jealousy was there again about, oh, you know, your mom is there again, and she was there to help me with the baby, and, you know, and my father was amazing, trying to get me out walking.
Yeah,
and
didn't fit in with his plans, you see.
Just didn't like it. And honestly, like, my parents are amazing. They're the best ever. And you know, they're typical Irish parents who are there to help, but that wasn't going down well on the other side of it. So that, I suppose,
I just would like to think, as a dad, and of course it's easy for me to say, isn't it, but I would like to think as a dad myself that I would face up to a man who behaved that way to my daughter. You know, like, I'm only saying that. I'm not critical of you or your father, but maybe in a real life situation, I might be very much, you know, hands off and say it's none of my business or none of my concerns. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and look, I wasn't going to them too much either, Neil, I'll be honest. Yeah. I was never kind of sitting with him like I did in just before I left, I suppose. In the early days, you know, when baby number one came along, I wasn't going to him saying, you know, Dad, you've got to help me. You know, I did that eventually.
So they didn't know how bad it was.
How bad it was. Yeah. No, nobody knew how bad it was. Even today, Neil, I'm not somebody who goes around talking, you know, airing my dirty laundry. I really don't. I kind of, you know, kept everything to myself. But there comes a point where you just go, I need help. I need somebody to help me to get out of here.
But just before we move on to that aspect of the story, and we've covered a lot of ground up until, you know, heretofore. After these meltdowns or the silent treatment or the anger or the punching walls and kicking doors and screaming at you and videoing and everything, would he be very sorry and apologetic afterwards and promise
crying.
To change?
Yeah, the tears, it was always crying. You know, he would go through the, I'm so sorry, I'm looking at my behaviour, I was so wrong, you know, I'd get the messages, I'd get everything, you know, because there were so many times where I said, I'm gone, I can't do this anymore. I ended up sleeping in a separate room. I couldn't, I just, when you've got somebody that's being like this to you, it becomes, my skin starts to crawl, and it was just like, and I'd speak to my counsellor, and she would say, the behaviours, she says, that your experience is the behaviours of a seven-year-old boy trapped in a man's body. So she said, of course, as a woman, you're not going to want to sleep in the same bed as that person, because the actions and the behaviors are all child behaviors.
Did it ever become physically abusive?
There was a few occasions where I was so we were out, and I sat next to a sister-in-law of mine at a dinner, and he basically said, you should have sat next to me, and that it was something that small, and that escalated, and it's hard to talk about, but he dragged me across the floor of my parents in their house by the hair, and that was probably the first act of physical violence towards me. And then the next morning, he texted me from a cafe. We were here on holidays, and he said to me, can you please meet me in the cafe? And I went in, and honestly, Neil, I hate even talking about it, because it makes me, anyone listening is going to say, how stupid could you be? Just walk away. But it was, I sat there and he cried, and, you know, said, I never should have done that. You know, I was under the influence of alcohol. I'm so sorry. And again, I went back again.
But did he repeat that physical abuse again?
There was times where I got pushed over, and then he pushed me over a couple of times, and I hurt my arm. I told him, I said, I think I've hurt my arm, and he stood over me laughing, and took his phone out and videoed me while I was on the floor. So
that videoing, that's another weapon, you see. He's weaponizing the video, you see.
And it was it was the vulnerability, and it was. That was tough. It really was.
Okay.
So that was
When did it actually come to a head then? When you say, because you had two very small children, where you said, and it was your home. I mean, you had a financial stake in it. Not to mention that it was your home where you were rearing your children. But you said, I have to leave this home.
Sorry, Neil. So just to recap. So our home was back and abroad. In the other country. So
when you had the babies, you had them here in Ireland. Here. You didn't go back again. Okay, sorry.
No, never went back again. So the house that we bought together was still there, and that was being rented out. So I then, and I told nobody what I'm about to tell you, but the next thing was in my head, I started to become very strong, and I started to get a plan together. And I said, I will get out of this, and I know I will be okay. I don't know where I got my strength from, but there was a trip organized to go back to where we had our house. And I went ahead with that trip, but I knew deep down inside that I was out. I had plans made. I started looking for somewhere to live. So I started doing a lot of background work, and obviously he knew none of this. We went back to where we'd been living together before kids came along, and I started getting my affairs in order, to do with the house and just tidying up some stuff. And then it came to a head actually whilst we were back there. That's when it all came to a head, and we were staying in a holiday kind of a home while we were there, and one day I just, again, something happened again, another incident where it was to do with me seeing my friends, and he didn't want me seeing them, I basically, it came to a head and I just said, I'm done. And I remember the time, I remember the date, I remember everything so well because it was such a profound moment for me, I suppose, to be able to do that. And I just said, I'm done, I am so done. And that didn't go down very well at all. And that, I suppose, for me then, Neil, the real abuse started from that moment on. So everything I've told you so far, I suppose, is from the day that I said I'm out, the stuff that started to happen after that was worse than what was happening while I was there before I left.
But there must have been pleading and begging and I'll never do it again and don't leave me.
Oh, that went on for weeks.
Yeah.
So we left. We had another week or two left in this place, and then we left. When we left, and this is, I suppose, a big moment for me. When we left, we were at the airport, and he said, I went up and to get on the plane, and I had a young baby in a buggy, and I had a toddler by the hand. And I said, and I looked at him, and he said, if you choose to do this, and if you choose to go down the road of being a single mother, he said, from today on, I will start treating you like a single mother. And he did that, Neil, and he lived up to his word. He said, I will make your life hell. And he's done that for the last however many years to this day. We got on, I went to get on that airplane, and I looked at him, and I said, can you please help me to fold this buggy down so I can get on the plane? And the air hostesses were standing looking, and he folded his arms, he laughed, and he said, you're a single mother now, do it yourself. We had a journey, we had an airplane journey back to Ireland and all the way back. Anytime I needed something, a nappy for the child, a bottle, can you pass that to me? Nope, do it yourself now, you're a single mom.
Why was he coming back with you? Why didn't you just leave on your own?
I wouldn't have been that lucky, Neil. I, honest to God, he was coming back. He wasn't leaving me go on my own. This was his home in his eyes now, even though his other children were back there, and he should have stayed there.
Okay, more from Laura after the break. Just let me mention one thing. If we go back to the conversation, the country overseas is not identified to protect the privacy of those involved in this story.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Got off the plane and your father was there to meet you, but you said that from that point onwards that your life then became a living hell, as if it wasn't already. How did it get worse?
I told him he had to go. He wouldn't go. So I had to go. I had to leave the home with my two kids. Eventually he went back to his mother for a couple of weeks, and when he did, that was when I made my, I call it my escape. I had family that came down and they just packed everything up for me, and I had my place to go to, where I still reside today. So that's where I went to, and where nobody knew any of the history, nobody knew anything. But when I say it got worse, it got 10 times worse. The abusive messages, the emails, the using the children as the pawns, which still happens today, even though they're much older. There was times where I said to myself, why did I leave? It would have been easier to stay.
No way.
It was financial abuse then, that he stopped paying any money towards the children. He would hack into my account to have a look. He found out that I went on a holiday once, and he said, well, if you can afford to go on a holiday, you're definitely not getting any money off me. So there was 2 years where he paid nothing towards his children. I would allow him to, and the big thing for me is I was saying the kids deserve a father. They deserve to have a relationship with a father. So for the first probably 6 months of me moving into this new home, I would allow him to come to the house and to spend every second weekend with the children, but I would leave and I would go to my parents' house, and that's what would happen. But one particular evening when I came home from my parents' house, he was upstairs in my bed, and I went up, I'd never had an encounter with a guard before, ever. In all my years, and this was the first of many then from then on. So basically what happened was, he was in my bed, I went up the stairs, the kids were asleep, and I said, what are you doing? and he was on his laptop, and I said, you need to get out of the bed. And he goes, I'm sorry, I paid for this bed as well. I'm staying here.
Oh,
and
crazy.
He wouldn't go. So
you called the guards?
I didn't call the guards, but this is then what happened. I took his laptop from him because I knew that was his life, because that was his business, it was everything. And I went to walk out the door, and he jumped up and he grabbed the laptop and pushed me against the wall. And then he ran into the ensuite. He locked himself in the ensuite, and he called the police, and he told the police that he's been attacked by his wife. The policeman came to the house. I had gone downstairs at this stage, and I sat down, and I was just dumbfounded, actually. The policeman came to the house, and he said, what's going on? Because I suppose he looked at me and said, have I come to the right house? And I said, yeah, look, I said, my husband is upstairs locked in my bathroom, and he's saying that I attacked him. I said, and it's actually the opposite, I said, and I told him the situation. He went upstairs, he brought him down. He said to him, whose name is on this house? And I said, mine. And he told him, go pack his bag. So he basically got rid of him. And then I never had him back in the house again. But then what he did was he came into the house one particular day when I wasn't there. He came to collect the kids. And when I'd left to go to work, I didn't realize that he'd actually left the back door open. He went in around the side of the house. He went in the back door. He went into my house. He took the kids' passports. He took their birth certificates. He took everything. He took my wedding rings, my engagement rings, and he left. And for 4 years after that, he used the passports as coercive control. We had holidays cancelled, trips cancelled. He wouldn't hand passports over.
When you say holidays and trips were cancelled, by whom?
Me. So I'd book a holiday with the kids, and I'd ask him for the passport.
Oh, I see.
And
he would say,
you tell me who's traveling with you first. Give me all the information. So I'd give him the basic information, flight details and stuff. And then he'd say things like, he'd ask really ridiculous things like, is there anybody else traveling with you? And if there is, I want all their details. Like, it was
God,
just...
What a nightmare. God,
and then
nightmare.
And then obviously I wouldn't give anything. And then he'd say, well, I'm not handing passports over. And again, looking back, I should have went straight to... But nobody was listening. I just felt there was no one listening.
You had been robbed. That was a matter for the Gardaí.
Yeah, well, he didn't look at it like that. He said, I'm entitled to them. I'm their father.
I don't know about that. I mean, you know.
And again, it wasn't in me. I'm not the type of person that runs to the guards. Like, it wasn't in me. And now that you're saying that, I'm looking back on, I should have went straight to the guards that day.
I know, I'm not saying it to be critical of you in any way, shape or form. Don't get me wrong in that regard. So did it continue? I mean, did he stay in Ireland then?
Yeah, he did. He moved very close to me. Well, when I say very close, probably 20, 25 minutes away. And then I applied for separation. And in the meantime, I asked him if he was going to pay me any money, and he would say, like, and I don't know why I kept them, but I still have the recordings, and there'd be recordings like, you know, go get a job, you know, you're a single mom now, get a job, sell your car and get the bus was another one, you know, I can't believe where you've moved to, you know, you should have moved to Knockmaheeny. You moved to an affluent area, you know, you're a single mom now, you shouldn't be living there, we're laughing at you here. Like, it was just constantly putting me down.
Totally, to strip you even further of your self-esteem, the confidence you were trying to build up in yourself, but also an awful lot of jealousy going on, because he doesn't want you to be strong, it doesn't fit his narrative, he's panicking, you know, he doesn't like the person that you're turning out to be. But you did divorce him.
Yes.
But even that wasn't a finality, was it? Because you said to me that words to the effect of, people like this never leave you rest in peace at all.
No, they don't. Until my children are at an age where they can make their own choices, Neil, I think this is something that will obviously and unfortunately be very prevalent in my life. I've become very strong around it. I've got the tools to navigate my way through it. You know, I've had to block him from different, you know, from my phone, from everything. You know, that was about a year and a half ago. I did that. But, you know, every way he can to get to me, it's like they look for the supply, And when they're not, when the supply is gone, they're going, how do I get more supply from this person? So it's throwing a grenade in with something else.
And sadly, you know something, he may well have started this kind of a relationship all over again with another woman. You don't know, you know, there could be another victim on the go. Do you think?
Well, there is, but I'm not going to comment on that.
Did you ever think of a barring order that would stop all of that?
Yeah, I did. I went, and again, Neil, I've been very let down as well by the court system here. I've never seen anything like it. They want you to go in and tell your story in 5 minutes. That's all you get. That's all you get. I had a story to tell, and I wasn't listened to. And my children, he got access, more access than any man in this country has. And my children to this day are struggling. They're struggling emotionally, they're struggling mentally, because now that he stopped the abuse with me, as in because he can't contact me through phones anymore, it's now emotional abuse towards the children. You know, mommy, can I please take my teddy bear that I really love when I'm going to daddy's to sleep with? Of course you can. I would let him take anything if it's going to help them. And they would come back after the weekend and my older child would say to me, daddy didn't allow him to bring his teddy bear into his house because it's from your house. Things like telling the kids, that's your mommy's house, this is your home. Never would allow the kids to call home home. And still to this day, he does that. That's not your home, that's your mommy's house. I'm doing everything to protect my children. The one thing I will say, and I'll hold my head high, I've never, ever said one bad word about that man to those children, ever.
No, I know. I can't.
And I was told, actually, I was told by a psychologist that you're probably causing what's called cognitive dissonance in the children, because when they come home and say things to me like, my daddy's not a very nice person, I used to say, your daddy's wonderful. And I was told, stop doing that.
No, you shouldn't be. You'd stop saying that. Better off saying nothing at all.
Yeah, and I have stopped now. I don't say anything now because I was causing such a confusion to those children, because children feel.
Do you think that there are many other women? It isn't exclusively women. You know that. I mean, I think you probably know that.
Oh, Neil, I feel sorry for the men and women that are going through this. So if I had rocked up to court and I had bruises on my face, I would have been in a better position because I would have been listened to and I would have been heard. But because my bruises are internal and the mental damage that's done to me and it's doing to my children, because everything is internal, nobody listens. It's so hard.
It's an amazing story of courage and resilience. It's far from finished, though. We still have a little bit more of the tale of Laura's abuse to tell. In the meantime, feel free to text 086-8104-106 and after the break, and I'll pick up on the very final part of my conversation with Laura after 11. But I will give out some very important helpline telephone numbers for those may well be struggling following or listening to this interview or find themselves in situations where they might need help. So we'll give those helpline numbers after this break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Pick the conversation up after 11. Your thoughts are welcome as always. Pick up the phone 0818 104 106. You can text 0868 104 106. If you ever wish to share any kind of story going on in your life, you can always email neil@redfm.ie. I will never give out personal details or any information if you don't wish me to do so. Some important phone numbers, though. If there was one number you were ever to give out on the air, it would be the Samaritans, because the Samaritans then can signpost you to any of the services or the help or the counselling or the intervention that you might need. They have all of the information for people. Samaritans number is 116123. 116123. But just two other important numbers for you. Women's Aid is 1-800-341-900. Women's Aid, 1-800-341-900. And Men's Aid is an 01 number, 554-3811. 01-554-3811. Men's Aid, actually. I know we're talking about the conversation through the prism and the lens of a mother and a woman, but men also are impacted in situations like this. They've also got an email, hello, H-E-L-L-O, hello, at mensaid.ie. So we'll pick it up after 11. Thank you.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation, the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. If you have something that you want to actually think about and a story to tell, you can always email neil@redfm.ie. I'm here for you, and
Happy to read out your emails on air, Neil, at redfm.ie. We have a pair of Damien Dempsey tickets for Live at the Marquee to give away sometime between now and midday. He plays the Marquee and does so on Saturday, the 8th of June. It's early to be giving tickets away, but I thought, why not? Why not? Just let's do it and we can do the bulk of ticket giveaways then as we get a little bit closer to the summer. So all of the gigs at the Live Marquee are now open for ticket purchase. Ticketmaster.ie. You got the Sugar Babes, you got Lyra, Brian Adams, Van Morrison, the Coronas, Gavin James, Christy, John Bishop the comedian, lots more besides that. So a Damien Dempsey song sometime between now and midday today. The final section of my conversation with Laura after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Do you have people calling to your home at night in form of harassment?
Yeah. So basically, what he was doing was he was meeting people and paying them to go to the house inverted commas, to serve a document. So it might be something to do with, this is my affidavit of stuff that you've done. It might be, you know, the kids were really upset, they didn't want to go on a particular day, and, you know, I didn't send them. And then it was like, okay, you've just breached an order, and he'd run to the court, and then he would send, so he'd pay. I was sitting at home at 9:30 one night, and this man just turned up in this van, and I'm sitting going, okay, but he parked up the road, and everything was very suspicious about the way he was. And I was on my own at home, and he would have known I was on my own at home, and he, you know, this man came to the door, and I obviously didn't open it because I said, well, is he parked up the road, and no, are you knocking on my door? So I ignored it, and he came back for 4 nights after that, late nights, and I was petrified. So I ended up getting his registration details, and I ended up looking into who it was, and then we found out that it was this guy that was paying him personally to deliver something to me. And again, that never got delivered because I never opened the door. And then it only happened again just very recently. He paid somebody else, but the guy that he was paying was coming to the house, and twice he came to the house, and as it happened, my sister-in-law happened to be in my house at the same time, and she opened the door, and he handed the papers to her and served her by mistake. So it was mistaken identity. So he intimidated her, and then he sneaked up on her another night, and she had her boot open of her car, and he sneaked up behind her, and it was all on CCTV. And he basically served the wrong person again. So it's relentless. It's endless. There's no end to it. I just can't even relax in my own home now. It's just constant. He just doesn't want to let me alone.
Yeah, you need to go to the guards. You just do. You know, you need to start a criminal investigation. I don't know what other options you have. It's all so messy, isn't it? I mean, it just goes on and on. All different forms of abuse.
I've got a fantastic partner in my life. I have a great job. I'm getting on with my life. I'm trying to stay positive. When I'm around the parents at the school and at the kids, you know, sporting activities, I have a smile on my face. I'm just constantly, you know, if anyone knew what was really going on, they would be absolutely astounded. But I've come out the other side. I'm definitely a lot stronger. But when we got divorced earlier this year, there was a lull. Everything went quiet for a while, and I just said to myself, I feel so free. There's nothing is coming at me. And somebody said to me then, just watch this. They said, when everything was so quiet for a while, they just said, just watch it, because there's something going to come at you, because these people just don't go away. And they were 100% right. And it came back at me again just very recently. And I just think, will it ever end? Will he ever just leave me alone?
Will he eventually just burn out, you know?
Oh no, there's just, I've done the research on this type of personality, and they're above the guards, they're above the doctors, they're above everything. They are in their heads, they know everything, and they're untouchable. And that's the thing, Neil, he is untouchable. He is using our court system, our Gardaí, wasting their time. He's not even working in this country, and he's using our resources to basically intimidate me.
Yeah, I'll make her pay.
Where's my protection?
Yeah, I'll make her pay. I'm glad that you're as strong as you are, though, in spite of everything that you're going through. You know, you do sound as if you're, I mean, you sound angry and you sound frustrated, and, you know, but at least you have those powers to express those emotions, you know? Why would you want to share your story, though, I'm wondering?
I want to tell any woman out there that's going through, or that has gone through, or is still going through, that they can absolutely walk away. Is it? I'd be lying if I said it gets easier when you walk away, because it doesn't, not with these type of people, whether it be a man or a woman. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get easier, but you need to protect your children, and that's the bottom line. You need to protect yourself, your own mental health, and your children. And I have never looked back. I know there's been times where I've been weak, and you know, when you see, like, my children are very anxious, and I see it in them. And you know, when your child is looking at you saying, please don't make me go, and you have to send them, and you know that the abuse that you went through, and you say to yourself, is this abuse happening to them?
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
When that's the part for me, Neil, that breaks my heart. I look at my children, and I forced them for years out the door. I forced them for years, and I said, you just have to go. I went to him and I said, can we just keep the kids at home for one more day? They're struggling today. Nope, court order. And that's all that ever came back to me. And I was so afraid of breaking court orders that I would just send the kids struggling. And I worry now today that I'm the one that's actually done this to their mental health.
Yeah, that's an awful burden to bear, you know.
All I can do is educate my children. And, you know, I always teach them about, invisible armour. You know, just to have your own your own protection. I talk to them about, you know, using your voice and being allowed to use your voice, and you know, understanding what it's like to be heard, and because they're not heard, and everything, and again, everything is it's on the outside, it looks like, oh yeah, it's fantastic. He portrays himself as this fantastic father who would just do anything for his children, but when you look at it, their emotional well-being is not at the forefront for him. It's the image. It's the, no, you wear this, you wear those clothes because that makes me look better. You do this, you do it that way. He won't allow them, you know, the control he has on the children now, it takes me back to what he used to be like with me. Yeah. And I just see it happening to my children in front of me.
Yeah. So what is your next move?
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm lost. I have a heading here in front of me. It says Nowhere to Turn. It was typed on the 9th of November 2023, and I typed it to you. I remember where I was. I was sitting on my couch, and I actually thought I was having a nervous breakdown. It was probably my lowest moment. And I thought, I'm definitely having a nervous breakdown. I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And I typed an email to you. And I just said, Neil, please, can you just put something on air just for somebody to help me? I don't know what to do. I'm not being heard by anybody. And I'm just in a really awful situation. I never sent it to you because I didn't have the courage back then. But I found it tonight when I was looking back at my notes. But I did. I got to a point. I pulled in at the side of the road one day in my car on this particular day. And I put my head on the steering wheel, and I had some awful thoughts, because I just don't know how I can physically and mentally go through this for the rest of my time. And I know I sound like a strong person, but there's only so much strength that you have before you actually break. And these people, that's their intention, that's their goal.
I hope that people reach out and maybe share their own experiences or give you some direction in that regard. But I certainly would not rule out, you know, the criminal route. I just wouldn't, you know. It's there now. The laws were strengthened against this in the recent years. You know, it's just a bit of advice. I mean,
I certainly take it on board, Neil, and I really appreciate that.
Stay in touch, though, will you, please?
Absolutely, I will, 100%.
And I hope sharing your story helps you in some way, you know. I hope it does.
Yeah, and I hope it helps other people, Neil, more importantly. I really do.
True, it certainly will. Look after yourself. Thank you so much, Laura. Mind yourself.
Thank you.
Damien Dempsey, Hope Calling. Hope is my home, he says. That's a very powerful song. I want to thank Laura for her courage in coming on and sharing her devastating story. And I hope that talking and sharing helps her. And I hope that, that life will improve for her and her children. She's in a very, very precarious situation now, watching her children grow, of course, and the impact
of a toxic relationship upon them. The Samaritans, people have been asking for, interestingly, just a typical example, you gave out those telephone numbers so fast, I didn't get a chance to note them. Could you repeat the telephone numbers for daddies, please? It's for my son. His wife uses parental alienation as her weapon of mass destruction and punishment against him. Parental alienation. It's going on for 9 years now. So that telephone number would be gratefully appreciated. Could you imagine, just think about it for a moment, for whatever went on with regards to a relationship breakdown between two adults as to why ever that would happen. But could you imagine for 9 years the viciousness and the evilness involved in using children as a weapon, but yet it happens. Just because a relationship breaks down where two adult people should have more sense, but unfortunately not always that way. Men's Aid are on 01 554 3811. 01 554 3811. Women's Aid are on 1-800-341-900. Talking really does help, and you can get direction, you can get advice, and you can get help. So Women's Aid are 1-800-341-900. And the Samaritans, who are an incredible organization and literally will signpost you in any direction that you need help in. Samaritans are on 116-123. Now, I have no phone lines, and I have no internet. I have no WhatsApp, so it'll be just you and me chatting away, I'd say, for the next 25 or 30 minutes, unless things change. But that'll be fun too, won't it, lads? Back after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
And I don't mean for a moment to take from the gravity of, say, Mary's situation with her husband. They've been together for over 10 years, but only living 2 years. She is trapped in the home. He's out at work, and he's his hobbies at the weekend. He's rarely home, and he's always complaining when he's home that it's stressful with the children. One of the children has special needs, and he says, you're overreacting. He brushes it under the carpet, says there's nothing wrong with the child. And of course, that's scary, actually, because the child needs intervention. The earlier the intervention, the earlier the help. It's a bit like all of the poor children in Ireland that can't get operated on with scoliosis. And time, of course, is like a ticking time bomb. It needs to be sorted very, very young because of that spinal differential. But anyway, she does all the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry, the shopping, the school runs. He says, Ashley, you get a break when you go off shopping, don't you? That's enough for you. That kind of nonsense. Now, that is very serious. Of course it is, to the woman who's going through this. There's a big response to that. I'm quite sure that you're texting and calling me now, but I haven't got phone lines regarding Laura's story, so I will pick up on your thoughts on that one. But from the email of the lady who's living with a narcissist, you know, a man who just isn't being a man, if you like. I don't think the husband is being very supportive of his wife and family needs now, is he? Why should he go off and have his hobbies and his wife can't do anything for herself? I mean, think about that. Grocery shopping, Neil, is not a hobby or a pastime. It's a chore. They both need to get counselling together as a couple, see if the marriage can be salvaged. Maybe it can, but he needs to change his selfish attitude, and that would be a start, says Linda. Another one here says, that lady began by saying that she is a stay-at-home mom by choice. I wonder what the husband would have to say about carrying the family financially on a single income. My wife and I both work full-time, and she works from home, so we still need to pay a child minder to mind our youngest. My wife constantly says that she would do anything to not have to work and spend her time instead as a stay-at-home mom. I don't know the husband, I don't know his side of the story, but it wouldn't be surprising if her unhappiness was infectious, and that's why there's no relationship between them when he's off work, I should say. This lady also said that she lost herself, so maybe that's where the solution lies. If she focuses on how she can improve her own life, find new hobbies, find new friends, improve her mental state, that might improve her relationship with her husband. I know it's hard to find time with kids around, but surely there's something this lady can do for herself while the kids are at school or sports time. Maybe she just needs to be more assertive and set time for herself a couple of times a week, in the evenings or at weekends, whether he likes it or not. But what if he, but what if he doesn't like it? What if that just turns the temperature up even more? I mean, this is a man who says his idea of a wife getting a break is doing the food shopping. A man who says, you're at home all day. You don't need hobbies. Is that, I mean, it's selfish, isn't it? It's self-centered. My husband works 12 hours a day. I never asked him to do the housework when he came home, as I knew he was physically, I knew he physically couldn't. These women need to be assertive, make a life for themselves. I had a solution. I got a cleaner in every Friday, so there was less to do at the weekend. And then I had a brilliant life. Oh, yes, indeed, says GP. Let's hear the man's side of it, shall we? You have plenty of women giving their tuppence worth, as one would expect. But most men do what their wives want, because most women want to control everything, you see. At least that is what I've seen through my years. You know, happy wife, happy life, etc. Another few. I don't see how she explains that she gets no time to herself. Once my little boy started school, I found I was twiddling my thumbs, waiting for him to finish school. That's a long day twiddling your thumbs then, isn't it? There are plenty of hours in the school day for her to get out and about and do things for herself, while also getting the house in order. He does sound like he's difficult, but the email is very one-sided, isn't it? With her really dwelling on what she can and can't do. There's someone who, when her little boy started school, she had nothing to do all day. If a man came on the radio and spoke the way she did, it would be called sexist. Everyone would want to hear the woman's story first and wouldn't believe what the man is saying, and the man would have to leave. You don't know the man's story, do you? You don't know the manipulation that women put men through, do you? And all the stuff men go through because of these twisted women. Wow. Let me just do one or two more, if you don't mind. I'm in a very similar situation to the topic email that you read out, but it's reversed. I'm a house husband and my wife is working full time. We have two kids and our marriage has failed. Trust me, it's not so easy to leave for either party. Where are we supposed to go? The current cost of living crisis and the housing shortage is a huge problem, and many, many families are suffering in this country. I don't think this man bashing is appropriate on your morning show, because trust me, women are just as able and can do much better manipulation of a situation to suit themselves than a man. My advice to this woman would be try to appeal to his good nature, if he has one. Take time to sit down and discuss. Lay your feelings out on the table. Do not give them a note. Don't write it down. Lay it down. Speak. Verbalize it. Trust me, you give someone an ultimatum and they're going to get defensive. Okay, some of the recommendations yesterday, me including, was ship up, or shape up or ship out. But he's saying that that can lead to defensiveness and it'll just ratchet up the situation. Final one for now. Listening to the woman on the email and her wanting me time. And Neil, my time with my children was all I ever wanted. I never wanted this me time. I did all the home stuff and always had the dinner ready. Don't forget that this man is working all day and I'm sure this is stressful. That woman should think of switching roles with him, as a lot of men would like to do what she's doing, I'm sure. When you have children, your life changes totally. And isn't that what we wanted in the first place? Says Marie in Clon. So text 0868104106. I won't be getting anything with regards to your texts or your updates on air this side of midday, because I don't have phone lines or texts or Wi-Fi. But I still have a lot to do. So we'll pick it up after the break. Text 0868104106 anyway and react. And when I can pick up on your stuff, I will.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
And from this morning then, we're talking about all of this, these crashes and the delays on the road and the fact that fatalities are way up on our roads, and it's going to be a shock in 2024, and the reason that people are crashing and all of the different aspects to that, driving, texting, taking phone calls, you know, jumping lanes, tailgating, acting the general fool. Just arrived in Little Island after massive queues in the east all morning. Did you know that people were creating a lane in the hard shoulder as well? You know, it's almost a kilometre back from the official slip, for God's sake. We're all in a rush, and this is just dangerous. Lots of people getting in touch with that this morning. When all of the traffic was backed up, people decided to create another lane in the hard shoulder. And then when there was no hard shoulder, would you believe it? They were driving on grass, or they were driving on stone chippings. Listening to the lady Rachel about the woman who broke down at the Dunkettle roundabout. My car broke down outside my housing estate last week in Mayfield. We needed to push it in off the road. My sister and young kids were trying to push it, and then a girl pulled up to help. Vans and cars were passing and watching, full of men. Not one of them stopped. Eventually, one man came to help, and some neighbours stopped, and we were able to get the car off the road. I was so grateful for those who stopped and helped. Yeah, but look at all of the people, able-bodied. You say a lot of men in vans and cars looking but not stopping, seeing you trying to push a car, you, your sister, with young children. I mean, it's all wrong. That poor lady that broke down on the old Dunkettle Road round about at 20 to 10 at night was in a very vulnerable position on the road. This is somebody who obviously came upon it. She was blocking the inside lane, which unfortunately was being used for all the eastbound traffic diverted from the new Dunkettle interchange that was closed for works. Rachel's husband pulled his car up onto the roundabout to assist her. However, the broken down car remained in a dangerous position, and it shows how important it is to have lay-bys for breakdowns like this. It should be mandatory in road design. This is a road safety and traffic management issue. Cars will break down. People will have accidents, but there's never a contingency plan for either eventuality. Hold on a second. Haven't I seen signs down around there, which is an emergency breakdown number? It's free of charge, and a tow truck will come along. It's hanging around the area all the time, I believe. Now, before texts broke down on me this morning, I did get just a few coming in with regards to the abuse that Laura is continuing to go through, different aspects of her life and different forms of abuse, never ending. My friend is going through the same domestic abuse at the moment, nearly exactly the same, except the children are older and are hugely influenced by their father. As the social worker involved says, it's parental alienation, and bullies are hard to deal with as they are usually dishonest, spiteful and jealous, and inflict that spite on everyone. Our circle of friends are standing by her, but even with the barring order, there is still sneaky manipulation ongoing. And that is at the hands of a father, an ex-partner. Does this guy have an opinion on this story, I wonder? Where's the balance in this? Maybe he was a bad guy, but you're only listening to one side of the story. That's all that's available to me. A conversation like that is the conversation through the prism of Laura, which was very heavily legaled by my legal people before it ever got to where. Do you really think that if I got in touch with the ex-partner? I don't know. You know, maybe. But I wouldn't want to be poking that bear. This is a wonderful book that has helped so many women and men. Well worth checking out and mentioning on your show. If it really helps open up the eyes of a person being abused who is confused, then it's worth calling it out. The book is by Lundy Bancroft, and it's called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. Why does he do that inside the minds of angry and controlling men? Now, don't for a second think that I am underestimating the amount of men that find themselves in coercive or abusive or manipulative relationships, ex-relationships, failed relationships, where there's toxicity and where there is manipulation of children involved. I've spoken to enough men in the past to know that this also exists, and it really and truly does. Okay, listen, I'll tell you what, I had a very, very strong conversation recently. It was back in February, actually, with a woman by the name of Emma Cosgrove. She's an obstetrician at Cork University Maternity Hospital. Admitted that the earlier... No, actually, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, the introduction you're giving me. There was an inquest recently involving the birth of a child, and there were failures admitted by the COMH at a meeting with Emma. Her son Kyle was born and declared dead after about 40 minutes. It happened in September 2020. I caught up. This all went through the courts, and it was, you know, very much reported on at the time. If there had been earlier intervention, the COMH admitted, if there had been earlier intervention into what was repeatedly being flagged as a high-risk pregnancy, then her little child, Kyle, would have been born alive and probably would have lived. It's an awfully tragic story. It's a very difficult thing to come on air and talk about something like that, but I did catch up and have a chat with Emma regarding the death of her beautiful son a few weeks back. Here's what she had to say. Emma Cosgrove, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking the call, Emma. And I don't wish to overly upset you as you share the tragic events and to some extent have to relive them again regarding the passing of Kyle. I read, and many did, the inquest, and then subsequently saw the High Court action. But can I bring you back to that day in September of 2020? Can you help us to understand what happened that led to Kyle's passing as a brand new baby boy?
I had been admitted to COMH to be induced on the 8th of September And the reason being, I'm a high risk patient. I suffer from high blood pressure, which I've had outside of pregnancy for years, since I was in my 20s. So I would be considered a high risk patient in pregnancy. I'd had a previous pregnancy and my blood pressure had increased really high in that pregnancy, and I had a lot of medication. So I had been admitted and I was induced because they didn't want to go any further than the 39-week mark. So I was just, I think, 2-3 days off of the 39 weeks. Everything was fine. At that stage, I'd had some heart monitoring of the baby up in the ward and everything was fine. There was no concerns or anything like that. And then I was taken down to the labour ward then, and the labour kind of, I suppose, ramped up, and they had decided that they would break my waters and that they would take a monitor of the baby's heart. When they took, I think, the first monitor, the CTG monitoring of the baby's heart rate and my contractions, they said that there was something, what they defined as suspicious, non-reassuring or suspicious on the CTG. They said, yeah, that they were a little bit concerned with his heart rate. So they would perform a blood sample where they take a little sample of blood from the baby to check how the baby is doing, and everything was okay. So we were reassured, I suppose, at that point. And then they had said that they had alerted the theatre and said, oh, you could possibly be going in for a C-section if need be. But they said, look, because this result is normal, we'll keep going and we'll just keep monitoring you. Mm. They broke my waters, as I said, and then the labour was progressing. And then the night shift ended and they have a handover of patients. Doctors on that round, ward round, decided that they'd take another, when they were finished the ward rounds, they would take another blood sample just to check the baby again, because this was a few hours later. They told me the result was normal. It actually was. It did fall within the normal range, but it was 0.1 away from being borderline, where you would be a lot more concerned and where you would have to take other actions. After that, we didn't really see any doctors or anyone, just literally the midwife who was looking after me was in the room, and there were some students, and we were just kind of left, and we didn't have anyone come in and give us any information or communicate anything to us. So we assumed that because that result had been okay and that nothing was happening, that, you know, we were trying to reassure ourselves that everything must be okay, because if not, they would be rushing me off to the theatre.
For a cesarean section, is it?
For a cesarean section, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
That didn't happen.
So that didn't happen. We assumed, oh, we're fine, you know, yeah, they're not rushing me off, everything's okay. And we were kind of laughing and chatting, and almost, you know, we just honestly just thought everything was fine. And in the meantime, my blood pressure had become extremely high, so they had to give me more medication for that. I had started vomiting. I was in extreme pain. I just wasn't very well at all. So they had called a doctor, I think, on the phone, and they had advised that they give me more medication, and they gave me some medication for the vomiting. And then eventually, I think about 11:30 to 12 that morning, a doctor came in then, and they said that they were going to do another exam and check how dilated I was and was I ready. They were a little bit concerned, so they decided to call a consultant in. So that would have been the first time I would have seen the consultant then, who hadn't been involved in my care at all. This consultant just happened to be there. So she came in and she had a chat with us and told us that they were a little bit concerned about the readings that they were seeing on the CTG, because Kyle's heart rate was dropping, but it wasn't recovering after the contractions like they would expect it to. And they said, oh, you know, it's possibly the what I think it could be causing it is that the cord could be around his neck, but that's not something that we're overly concerned about, because that happens a lot and it's a common thing. And we're going to just do another blood sample again, just to check that the baby's happy and that he's okay. And then we should hopefully be ready to start pushing. And everything seemed fine. So the doctor tried to take the blood sample and then she couldn't get the sample. So she called the consultant back in again, and then the whole kind of atmosphere changed in the place, and it was all very kind of, I suppose, it felt like there was an emergency happening, and lots of people came into the room, and they had said, oh look, we're going to try and deliver the baby with forceps, so we'll have to bring you into the theatre to do that. And I was a bit upset and stressed about that. And you know, they were kind of chatting to me, trying to calm me down, and they said, look, we'll give it one attempt, and if he doesn't deliver, we'll go straight to C-section. But I had asked, please give me a C-section. But they said, look, it's because you're almost fully dilated, we'll start with the forceps, which I wasn't happy about this, but this is what they told me was happening. So then they brought me into the theatre, and they told me that they were going to have an attempt at delivering him with forceps, and if it went okay, that they'd continue to deliver him. So they had me push, and then they were delivering him, and they said, "Oh, his head is here. Do you want to touch his head?" And they called my husband in, and then everything just changed then, and he was just delivered really suddenly and just whipped away from me, which he wasn't put on my chest as I had expected to happen, and he was whipped away. And I just remember that there was no sound, and he wasn't crying, and then lots of people started coming in to the theatre, and there still wasn't any cry.
You okay?
And then, sorry, it's just the difficult part. So then lots of people came in, and we could just hear them screaming, you know, to get blood and to get all the things they needed, and they started counting breaths, and we knew they were resuscitating him. But the staff that were with me kept telling me that he would be okay and that they were working on him. But we just knew there was something wrong, because we couldn't hear him at all, and it was taking too long. And then we just heard one little gasp, which we thought was him starting to cry, there was nothing again after that, and we just kept hearing the counting and the resuscitation breaths, and we just couldn't listen, or we couldn't look, and we just asked to be taken away from the room, because I just couldn't look at what was happening. It was just too difficult, and I knew that it was too long, and that he wasn't going to make it. And they removed me from the room, and I don't know how long later the doctors came in, but I knew the minute they walked into the room what they were going to tell me. But they couldn't. There was nothing they could do for him. And
was Kevin with you at that time?
And they had tried. Kevin was, yeah. Kevin was with me, yeah. And
yeah, total disbelief.
I've never been so shocked in my entire life at anything. It was just so unexpected. It was just literally the
he was just about to be born, handed into my arms, and then to go from that to that was...
And those,
I can't even give you words for it.
I was reading in the inquest that time in situations like this are so critical and so important, aren't they? Yeah. You know, missed minutes or missed hours. If it had been a couple of hours earlier, I read in part of the inquest where one of the consultants said, with an earlier delivery, that you know, baby Kyle would have lived.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah, like we had had a post-mortem and they had found everything to be perfect, you know, in every way, his growth, genetically, every way. There were no problems, nothing at all identified in that. And
was it?
He was.
Yeah, he was perfect in every other way. Yeah. There seemed to be a lot of breakdowns of communication along the way, a lot of people involved, but not all kind of linked up, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there just seemed to be so much confusion. It was really difficult to follow because there were so many different people, and nobody actually seemed to be, responsible for my care at all. It was just so jumbled in our brains as to what had happened, because people, like, we never really seen any particular doctor for, you know, any period of time where you could almost even recognize them again, or you know, it was like just people popping in very briefly and no one speaking to us or telling us anything at all, which foolishly we took as that everything must be okay.
But how are you to know any different?
And we didn't ask, because we assumed, but, you know.
The inquest showed a very different picture being painted, didn't it? Where one of the consultants told the coroner that it's actually very rare to lose a baby in the labour ward, that they usually can resuscitate. Poor Kyle was struggling for quite some time, and I know that'll upset you even me saying those words again, but if he'd been delivered a couple of hours earlier, as you said yourself, he'd be with you today. That's a hard thing to live with, you know. It's, and also,
I don't know how we will. Like, I don't know. Initially when he died, I was almost hoping to find out that it was something that had happened, like, naturally, or, you know, that there would be a reason. That I just always said, I don't know how I would handle it being a mistake or a fault or something like that, you know. It's almost, if it was something natural or something that just happened, like, maybe you could, I don't know, I know you never accept it, but just you could try and process it, but
it's nature's way or what have you, but this was not. That's why your words, the nightmare of resuscitation of our precious baby will haunt us forever, and no parent should ever have to go through this. This was deemed at the coroner's court as being medical misadventure. Did the CUMH apologise? Did they admit blame?
They have admitted blame now, and we had to ask for an apology, which we haven't received yet. We're waiting on that. It should be, I think it's a written apology that we're getting, but
that hasn't arrived yet. Well, it's kind of early days after the High Court settlement. The details of that are confidential, but it's very important that you brought that case for closure, as well as a lot of other. But the coroner was quite critical. I mean, the coroner said medical misadventure, and he said, if directions are given, who's responsible to see them through? There seems to be an unintentional breakdown of communication at various stages. And bizarrely, he said that instead of referring to a patient by the room number that they were in, would it not be better to refer to them by their name? That's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes. And the reason he said that is because the consultant who was actually in charge of my care during the pregnancy, and who had
taken excellent care during the pregnancy of myself and Kyle, wasn't informed that I was in labour and that there were any issues, but had taken a phone call and was told that patient in room number two, this was happening, but there was never a name given where the consultant would recognise.
That's got to change.
Me, because I would have been, you know.
That's got to change.
Yeah, because I would have had checks every week to 2 weeks during my pregnancy, because as I had said before, I was considered to be really high-risk patient.
How are you coping, Emma? Yeah. How are yourself and Kevin coping?
It's difficult. It's really hard to put in words how it's... It's just your it's just your worst nightmare, and it affects us every single day. It has affected us every single day since, and probably always will. Well, not probably will always affect all of us. Yeah, no,
it's awful.
It's not. It's just. It is. It's just awful that it can be. You know, that this can happen.
And just listening to you to chat with me, would it be right in saying that your advice to people who aren't sure is to ask questions? If you don't know, find out.
Yes.
Don't take anything for granted, do you think?
Absolutely. Or ask for another opinion, or, you know, don't be afraid to ask. You know, my husband had actually at the time been looking at the monitor, and he actually was concerned, you know, obviously he's not a doctor, but he had seen that, you know, Kyle's heart rate was dipping, and he had, you know, said to me that he was, you know, a little bit worried and should he ask some questions, and I stupidly had said, oh, you know, they know what they're doing, don't be annoying them by asking, which we obviously will always regret that we didn't do that. So definitely, I think if I would advise anyone who would have any concerns, because it seems like mistakes of the CTG readings happen, and, you know, it's definitely not the first time, and it's and probably not the last, sadly, that it will happen, that a baby will be lost because of that. So it's definitely something that, you know, I would advise people to be wary of.
Sage words of advice from somebody who's gone through so much. You know, what can I say, Emma? Our deepest condolences to all of the family on your sad loss.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing the story. Difficult and all, as I know it is. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, an avoidable tragedy, an awful nightmare for the family to go through, both Emma and Kevin, but so avoidable. The heart rate dropping, of course, it was determined at the coroner's inquest that would have been because of a lack of blood or a lack of oxygen going to the brain. Poor little baby Kyle, who was perfectly developed in the womb and there was no issues at all. Now, Emma was determined to have been a high-risk pregnancy, but earlier intervention would have clearly saved little Kyle's life, and he gave one small little tiny gasp when he was delivered, and that was it. Short life, no life at all, really. And thoughts are with Kevin, Emma, and indeed with Kevin. So that was part of this conversation involved the inquest, and then subsequent to that, there was a High Court action against the CUMH, and rightly so. Thanks, Emma. I do appreciate you coming on air. I know it's very hard to live with. I mean, I can't even imagine what you're going through, but thank you all the same. Our lines will stay open, lads. Be no phone lines for most this morning, but I hope that everything will be fine in the morning. I don't have Wi-Fi and I don't have broadband or anything else, so I imagine there's going to be quite an amount of texts and emails which I'll pick up in the morning. We covered a lot of ground. I thank everybody who did get in touch. Certainly, those of you that were caught up in the mayhem of crashes and traffic on our road and delays and bad driving, and also, of course, of control that we dealt with also. Tomorrow, everything will be well. Have a good day. I'll see you tomorrow.
When Cork talks,
Cork people blow my mind.
They talk to Neil Prendeville
on Red FM.